To Free City Radio. This is edition 251. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the program this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation I had with two independent community-based radio creators from Chicago who work on a project called Ergo. This is a project that really highlights community voices, community activism from the Chicago area. It is a project that has roots in the Black Lives Matter movement and the cultural atmosphere around Black Lives Matter, and has really successfully created a way to talk openly about community organizing and the intersections of art and activism that has really redefined a lot of youth culture in different neighborhoods of Chicago. I was really lucky to speak with Damon and Daniel from Ergo for Free City Radio, and I thought it would be really interesting to have sort of a mirror to another community radio initiative and podcast in the Chicago area here on Free City Radio. So here's our conversation. Chicago is a big and wide city, and there's just endless both histories of community organizing, and especially at the intersections of art and activism, but that also manifests in the contemporary, around the Black Lives Matter movements, many movements around prison justice, around, a lot of like the pressure that residents are feeling today around the inaffordability of the city and people really struggling to find housing that they can afford. So you are both working on an initiative called Ergo, and it explores a bit this intersection of art and social movements in Chicago. So maybe we could just first start, please both introduce yourself, and for people who are tuning into this, just please share a bit about the initiative. Thank you.
What's up, everybody? My name is Damon Williams from South Side Chicago, a co-creator, co-host of Ergo and Respair Production and Media. I'm also a movement builder, organizer here in the city in Midwest, and I'm a performing artist, facilitator, educator. And happy to be talking to you. I'm gonna pass it to Daniel and let him get the origin story going.
I'm Daniel Kisslinger. I'm the other co-host and co-creator of Ergo and Respair Production and Media. Ergo is a almost 9 year old initiative at this point. It's a long form living, humanizing subject to subject archive of the people creating liberatory pathways in Chicago and beyond. And so starting in 2015, Damon and I have been in conversation with movement workers, culture workers, through the different eras of political activation that have happened in this 9 years, but it was really birthed out of the emergent movement for Black Lives, as well as like a really vibrant moment in Chicago's cultural scene, hip hop scene, poetic scene that we were both either adjacent to or part of. And we felt this like kind of like crackling excitement of new possibilities, both creatively and politically. And we knew that for people who weren't in those rooms, they didn't know that was happening. And so the contribution that we wanted to make was to build a container to hold those conversations and to hold that work and make it legible to people, both in the moment, but also as an archive 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And so since then, we've, hosted and produced over 350 Ergo episodes, each episode talking to a different person. But we've also developed and published countless collaborative projects with other movement orgs, departments, individuals doing this important thought and political action work. And through that, 8 years after we started, we launched an umbrella organization called Respair Production and Media, which is a home for Ergo, but also for the other projects we do, and a home for other emerging movement media and movement journalism projects in the city as a way of supporting that whole ecosystem. So that's what we do as participant documentarians and participant journalists, is build ways for people who are doing liberatory work to have their stories told subjectively, humanistically, and comprehensively as a way of pushing movement forward.
Damon, you mentioned the South Side of Chicago and also mentioned doing movement work and doing arts performance. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could share a few examples through Ergo that you've come across that you would really like others to hear about, and maybe how that intersection in your experience in Southside Chicago works for people who are not familiar with the neighborhood.
In many ways, the structure that Daniel names of what our media work has been for both of us, and certainly for me, has not just been a way to like amplify what is happening, but a way to process and understand what I've been experiencing and, you know, coming into adulthood. And so, you know, I exist at the intersection of, you know, the work that we do. So artistically, you know, they're definitely in the early aughts, was a really dynamic overlap of hip hop, poetry, spoken word, and theater that was happening, kind of revolving around a network of open mics that were, many of them were youth centered. And so out of that, you get artists such as Pivot Gang, so that's Saba, John Doe, Joseph Chilliams, Fresh, MF and Mello. You get folks like Jamila Woods, No Name, Chance the Rapper, Mick Jenkins, and so on. And so, you know, to be around those folks, looking back at it now, it's like, oh yeah, obviously. But to be in that space in that moment where folks are just gathering on Tuesdays in a space for free, it felt like something historical was happening, and it felt like an honor and a privilege to be a part of it. And so not only wanting to remain present and learn more about that scene, wanting to contribute beyond my few, you know, rhyming syllables, wanting to help archive what was happening in real time. And within a few years of that experience, and really related to that, it really was actually starting from that communal base of poets and educators that the Let Us Breathe was formed, Let Us Breathe Collective was formed. And, you know, we began with support trips down to Ferguson, and what began as an effort or an endeavor to support became a transformational experience that then shaped the rest of our and particularly my life into building movement in the Black radical tradition. And so it started with supporting direct action and cultural activation in, you know, this epicenter of this new mode and form of resistance, and then trying to support being a bridge of what was called the Ferguson style of protest, I do with air quotes, to Chicago. And that led us towards, you know, deepening in an abolitionist practice and praxis, which started mainly in resistance to the extension of police killings beyond Mike Brown, and particularly, you know, folks in our city such as Rekia Boyd, Laquan McDonald, Ronnie Man Johnson, Pierre Lowry, and the survivors of torture by a CPD torture ring that lasted for decades and continues on in different legacies within our city. Working for reparations, working for justice with those families, deepened and concretized our abolitionist lens of, you know, we have these acute, discrete acts of horrific, life-altering violence, while at the same time building our vocabulary and deepening our different modes of data of how harmful this institution is holistically and structurally and economically and politically, through different invest, divest facing community building initiatives and political organizing. So that's basically the story. You know, Let Us Breathe Collective and the arts world exists within my spirit and are also like inextricably linked to the work of Ergo and Respair.
I want to get into one of the things you mentioned earlier, Daniel, about the idea of creating a living archive. So just to sort of note that. But before we get into that, Damon, I just had one quick follow-up question. You talked about CPD, so that's Chicago Police Department, for people who are listening. And that's the Chicago Police Department has become renowned for all the challenges to their practices and their connections and practices of torture and how it's affected people. You mentioned a bunch of things, and also going down to Ferguson, St. Louis, supporting the community protest there after Michael Brown was killed. We've had Damon Davis on this program before, who was very involved in that. And one thing that in speaking with other people, and I just wanted to pick up on this point because I saw a mirroring here in the early 2000s of these spoken word open mics, where a lot of people felt safe to express ideas that really weren't represented in political mainstream work and also were not represented in mainstream art spaces. And I think that's a really interesting point, and I don't know how much that's being explored, at least that I've heard, of like that connection between those open mic spaces and people finding voice in those contexts and sort of the patterns and what led eventually to being on the streets maybe a decade or 15 years later. If you could share any thoughts about that. I've heard similar links about other cities.
Yeah, you know, I think in Chicago, really starting in the 90s from what I understand, but I came of age in the early 2000s. There was this overlap of what became known as slam poetry and spoken word, hip-hop comedy actually was really important, particularly in the 90s and 2000s, even like neo-soul, jazz work created this constellation of independent interdisciplinary performance artists. And then my interaction began with it, I believe. So my father is a comedian, actually. So, he hosted a lot of interdisciplinary open mics, but that were comedy centered. But I faced it more directly through my older sister. So when I was probably like 10, 11, and 12, I began going to youth centered slam poetry competitions, namely Louder Than a Bomb, which the title was in the context of the Iraq War. And so it started, you know, as a way to name that, like, our voices are louder than a bomb and helping to politicize young people. And so from a very young age, I realize now these were 16, 17, and 18 year olds, but they, you know, as I'm 9, 10, 11, they seem so grown, was hearing radical consciousness articulated in these like underground, but also like you're not allowed to curse youth friendly spaces. So like they're really explicit, but you can't be vulgar, which also I think then was a construct that shaped people towards higher standards around social constructs and bigotry, is because, you know, where I'm learning to write and perform and find my voice is in a space that does not condone sexist, racist, homophobic, gender biased, and other forms of, you know, derogatory language. But you can still be raw, right? Like you can say explicit things, and you can curse sometimes, but you can't, like, you know. And so through Louder Than the Bomb and, you know, organizations such as Young Chicago Authors and mentors such as Brother Mike, there began this network of after school events, which is coinciding with the divestment from public arts education and public education. And then I think really came to a head in Chicago once there was a closing of 52 schools, which was the largest ever in the history of the continental United States. And so as young folks are getting scattered and now are having to wake up at 5, 6 in the morning to take buses across the city to get to school, spaces such as Kumba Links and U-Spirit Media or U-Media and then other folks, Young Chicago Authors, there would be these network of events, poetry slams, open mics, and this is where I was first organized. This is where I first came in contact with my friends being in an organization called Black Youth Project 100, which coincided with the death with the verdict in the death of Trayvon Martin in the case of George Zimmerman. And so in this space, we're speaking about the police, we're speaking about the government. Some of it is just metaphorical, some of it is just abstract. And so for us directly, the Let Us Breathe Collective, when Ferguson happened, you know, we had just got done doing this like theatrical multidisciplinary stage show that's all about how do we articulate revolutionary consciousness aesthetically? And once we saw our people rising up and in rebellion 4 hours away, you know, the things that we valorized in the 60s were happening in real time. And so it was really like a provocation of consciousness of like, if we are what we say we are, we have to be present for this moment. And, you know, it was happening in our community as well. Many of the folks who went on a delegation from Chicago to Geneva, to the United Nations called We Charge Genocide, charging genocide against the Chicago Police Department, were artists and poets who were friends of a young man named Damo, Dominique Franklin, who was tased and killed by Chicago police, supposedly over a bottle of alcohol. and so, yeah, there is this overlapping flow of divestment from the public infrastructure, and neoliberalism and the shrinking of public education and the lack of creative resources in schools, this network of mentors and independent artists and teaching artists that created these programs, and then this development of consciousness that then coincided when the moments of Trayvon Martin and school closure and Mike Brown happened. We have a space to gather. We have a space to convene. We've been building language and standards and values of practices around class, gender, state violence. And then, you know, that was at the foundation and the soil of how I then met activists and other folks who were organizing, and how, you know, really our movement context blossomed here, especially through the abolitionist lens.
So you mentioned the constellation of situations and also organization. And you know, thank you for going over that and sort of going over that arc. And, you know, I'd really encourage people to sort of, our archives are at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. So go back and listen to this again. And you've mentioned a number of like nodes in the Chicago infrastructure culturally and also in terms of activism. And it's really valuable to hear about that. So thank you. Daniel, building on what Damon was sharing, you know, you talked about the importance of archiving these spaces and these moments and these voices, and also thinking about how, I would assume that part of the idea through Ergo is to sort of have unofficial takes on history, you know, in the sense that like often things are rewritten, right? Like Biden wouldn't be president if Black Lives Matter hadn't happened, period, right? Like if people hadn't mobilized in Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, you know, those votes defeated Trump, not really elected Biden, right? But sort of there's a whole situation that is movement driven that really plays a big role in American politics that is not in the mainstream narrative. So any thoughts about that?
For sure. One, I agree with that analysis. Just in the 2020 context, I think that's an important point that in this election cycle has been detrimentally left out. That was such an important piece of how that happened, and that it wasn't like through debates and candidates. But yeah, I think the like kind of academic version of an archive is like flattened to the point that people don't think of it as something that's living, breathing, and something to engage with as part of your life. You know, Dame often tells the anecdote of like being someone who's politically interested in radical traditions, finding the name and history and legacy of Fred Hampton, and then looking for the footage and to hear his voice, and that there's really only about 60 minutes that you can find online of this like visionary world-changing person. And so that's one example of from jump. What we were trying to do was, if we are marking this moment as a historic moment, we want to make sure that the people who are leading that have at least 60 minutes of them telling their story in their own voice, in their own words, and that that's available for people now, but also for people doing research or trying to find their way into movement organizing on their own in the future. I think both of us have taken a lot of like fortification and like sense of self from the lineages that we've found, both like personally, communally, and politically. And I think it's something that I see people who don't have that grounding feel the weight of systems of oppression in a way that can be really debilitating. And I say that word like not without thinking about the like disability within the idea of the state enclosing on you, these, what that does to your body when you feel the isolation that that creates. And so for me personally, so much, I've been thinking even more about this in these days of like the healing potential of the archive. And that is true politically, but even just personally, you know, I was helping someone we were working with. They were starting to play around with some like AI tools about recreating someone's voice, sending them a birthday message, someone who's passed on. And, you know, at first I was very apprehensive. You know, we believe in non-synthetic intelligence over here. But I was looking, you know, in a Reddit thread of, you know, different options, different softwares to use. And almost everybody who is just a regular person looking for this software, looking for a recommendation, was looking for it in order to recreate a loved one who had passed, giving them love. And, you know, this, a media is just the plural of medium, which just means in the middle, right? It can be used in a lot of different things. It can be used toward a lot of different means. But there was something really telling to me that on a personal level, what people wanted this recreation of an archive to do, this synthetic archive, was to give them this like other moment of healing with someone who they lost. And so expanding that to a political context, what does it do to feel less alone because you have access to the voices, the ideas, the reflections, the pauses, the breaths of the people whose lineage you try to build in? There's like what it can do tactically and strategically, but in terms of just like emotional collective fortification, it's something that I've always known is important, but feels even more important, you know, day by day, week by week. It's just, it's like a human need and a movement need. And so from Jump, that was part of the contribution we tried to make. ErgoRadio.com, AIRGO Radio. You know, we're on the air, in the go. We love an entendre, as many entendres as we can pack in. And you can also find Ergo wherever you listen to podcasts. So, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, it redistributes to all those. Whoever you listen, it's there, AIRGO. And, you know, it can be, since we've had so many episodes, a lot to, like, find an entry point. So on the Ergo website, we've created, it's under the tab Dig in the Crates, and we've done some, like, thematic suites of episodes. So if you're really interested in hearing, you know, from kind of on the ground organizers, there's a suite there. If it's academics, writers, you know, a series really focusing on abolition, conversations with musicians, like we've done some of that cataloging and organization to make it a little easier, because it feels overwhelming for me sometimes to jump into 350 episodes of someone's show, and I'm the one who made this one. So we figured we might give a little entry point.
So Damon, you mapped out like your own experience and lineages around, you know, different spaces within which you grew as an activist and performer. And both of you have talked about the emergence of this current project, Ergo. Maybe we'll just end on this point, because I feel this is an important one. And I sort of was grasping this from both of your responses over our conversation, which is there's an urgency to create narratives and like clear political orientation because of the magnitude of injustice in both local and international contexts. There's a lot of people who feel really lost right now, to put it very simply. And that's not, I don't think, most of the time it's not on them, right? Like there's situations that play out and systems that play out that create that. And I really appreciate what you were sharing in terms of mapping out movement infrastructure. If you could share anything, Damon, about like how this podcast could be grounding in terms of like some of the gaps that we're facing now, because there is such a lack of sort of like movement grounding for a lot of folks who are really pissed about a lot of things, but maybe don't have outlets or clarity.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what was so important, transformative, difficult slash missed opportunity of what the 2020 uprising was, is that it offered this moment of visibility and this portal, this opening to this understanding of that there are a lot of people who at least are dissatisfied with this current oppressive order, many of which are committed or interested in building new worlds, new systems, new structures. And so that was really important. But at the same time, there was not, I would say, an adequate or sufficient communication infrastructure already established. So a lot of that got filtered through news or the algorithm of social media that made it very difficult and convoluted for just a person who's not participating. So I say all that to say, because my first thought was, I feel so privileged and fortunate to have had that on-ramp that we just named, right? And everybody is not as like prepared to activate and curious and place themselves in community like Daniel did with his life, right? Like, we kind of come to this from a unique position where we were able to see it with our own eyes and see some of it like before it even started. And if you do not have access to that, I can't imagine how you process through the world. You know, I can't imagine what it means to look at a presidential campaign or even your local alderman race, or understand the economy or understand prices as you're moving around or understand violence in community or understand gender dynamics without this recognition that movement articulates of that there are systems that are organized to affect our lives, and how you then place yourself without recognizing that there's a multi-century long tradition of people who are working to survive and keep us alive and create better, healthy outcomes. And so, yeah, in terms of the void and the gap, I do not think liberatory, holistic, radical, transformational politics is legible to the general public. I think some of the ideas and some of the modes can hit the masses in moments of provocation. But I think, dissimilar to the right, who actually does have a real connection to a grassroots mass base that is regularly organizing, I feel that what we are building can sometimes be veiled. And so to have conversation and it not be just content, but we really haven't come into this as content creators that are just looking for snippets or looking for clicks or looking for bites. We're really creating space. And I think that space, for those who are able to connect with it, and we're trying to work harder to connect with more people and make it more useful, can help you ground in literally your orientation to the world and how you see day-to-day life.
Thanks so much for chatting today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, appreciate you.
That was a conversation with Daniel and Damon of Ergo. That is a project based in Chicago. You can find them at ergoradio.com. Thank you to Mohammed Mehdi in Chicago for this suggestion. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you so much to the Social Justice Center at Concordia for supporting this project. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Jiajiaoge, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC, on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. You can look us up on your favorite podcast platform. Just search Free City Radio. We are an archive at soundcloud.com/Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and thank you for tuning in.